comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! It's Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Nerds United here on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network, available on iTunes. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, also Stitcher, but of course jitterymonkey.com. My name is Greg Mahochko, and if you go back a couple of episodes, and really a couple of weeks now that I'm trying to maintain a regular schedule of recording every week, it sometimes works, it sometimes doesn't, but a couple of weeks back and a couple of episodes back, I was joined by Michael May, the writer of Kill All Monsters, which we talked about at length. It was released in July, so over the summer, the Omnibus, the Volume 1 through Dark Horse Comics. I've been encouraging you to check that out through my Facebook page and check it out, pre-order it. Hopefully you've hit up your local comic shop, your LCS, if you will, and ordered that. I know I had ordered it, and I think it's... I haven't received the message that it's in yet, which is good. Maybe that means that it's so successful it's on back order. In talking with Michael, I teased that, you know, that was only half of the Kill All Monsters story. And this week, we're getting the other half. We're getting the origin story of the artist, Jason Copeland, and separated by two time zones and a national border as Jason joins us from the Great White North in Canada. Jason, welcome to Nerds United, and we've really got some foundation to lay here because you made a post before we ever, you know, started talking. You made a post on Facebook that said, hey, if any bloggers or podcast, you know, hosts want to interview me or put an interview together before ahead of Kill All Monsters, let me know. And it was our mutual friend, Jay Peter Onitz, who tagged me in it. And I'm like, hell yeah, let's get this going. That was back in April or May, something like that. And I shared this story, you know, a couple weeks back with Michael as well. The plan was, you sent me a PDF version of Kill All Monsters, which thank you very much. I read it. Mostly at my job at the time, sitting at the desk, and any free time that I had, I pulled it up and, you know, knock out a chapter or so. Loved the story. But you sent that to me, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get a review up before, you know, so people can, you know, get my thoughts on it. They can pre-order it. And what we had talked about, I said, yeah, it'd be great to get you and Michael on the show at the same time, get, you know, both creators in there. And then it became, you know... The calendar, the pages continued to turn, and I said, you know, I have an idea. What if we split this up into two parts, one with the writer, one with the artist, and then next thing we know, the book's on shelves, it's available, and we're doing this the end of August and now the early part of September. So that's a hell of a long introduction, sir, but welcome to Nerds United.
Well, thank you very much.
So this has been an ongoing process, like I said, for a few months. Kill All Monsters, Volume 1 Omnibus is out now, and Michael said that you guys are already working on Volume 2, which is fantastic. But before we get to Kill All Monsters and your other projects, I always like to get, you know, people when they join the show for the first time, I always like their origin story. So let's start at the beginning, and not the foreword, but let's go into Chapter 1, you know, the nice splash page. Tell us about Jason Copeland. What is your origin? What's your background? And I guess the launching point of that is, when did your interest first begin in comics?
I would say that my interest in comics started probably in about grade 8 or 9, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe 7, just going down the corner store and picking up issue of this and issue of that, and it wasn't until probably about grade 11 that I decided that that art was something that I was interested in. It was more easy to take in high school, not a lot of homework, that sort of thing, and then I realized that I was actually okay at it, so then I just stuck with it. And then I went to art school for too long, And that was interesting because of what happened in art school is that they tend to think of comic books as low art and not something that's not really worth pursuing. So just as I was starting to kind of get into drawing comics, I got kind of pulled out of drawing comics by all my instructors, and I ended up sort of abandoning comics for quite a few years. And then once I was out of school, you know, fast forward another, oh geez, like 6 years, and I was out of school, and I was just kind of thinking, well, I don't know if I really want to be a gallery artist, and I got drawn back into comics. I started going back to the comic book store and picking up a few titles here and there, and I was like, oh man, this would be a lot of fun to try, because I never really gave it a solid try when I was, you know, growing up. It was more just like splash pages and you know, pin-up type stuff, but the sequential stuff was not something that I had really worked on. And so then once I was out of school and I was started getting back into comics, I was just like, well, I'll give this a try. And so that was something that I was doing on the side while working full-time at different places and stuff.
Let's go back to the formative years when you said you'd go down to the corner store and you know, just pick up a book here or there. To me, it seems the more casual comic book, I guess, purchaser, the consumer maybe is a better word. You know, if they're not enveloped and really wrapped into a storyline, probably it's going to be some cover art that is going to catch their eye and maybe, you know, cause them to pick up that title. So was that the case with you? Like you said, when you were, you know, grade 8, grade 9, you know, just kind of, like you said, getting this or that?
Yeah, I guess it probably was covers. I mean, I'm a little bit older than probably I'd like to admit. So the stuff that was on the shelves or in the spinner racks when I was a kid was more like the beginning of the really great stuff in the mid '80s with at Marvel. So we're talking about like Thor, Walt Simonson Thor, Bill Sienkiewicz and New Mutants and that sort of stuff. The stuff that I was really drawn to was not, I guess at the time, wouldn't really be considered, you know, traditional comic stuff. And at the time, I think that a lot of those artists were actually taking a lot of chances, and Marvel was kind of coming out of this kind of dark age and, you know, just trying to shake things up and do some different stuff. So artists like Bill Sienkiewicz and Walt Simonson were doing things that I think were, you know, not normal, what I would consider normal comics. And I think that their art styles and that sort of risk-taking that was happening in those books was something that got me involved in comics, because it wasn't what I had traditionally thought of as comics.
Would it have been like groundbreaking stuff that they would be doing at the time? Is that what you'd consider, or...?
Well, yeah, I mean, like Simonson's Thor, like there has never been. I mean, I've read a little bit of Jason Aaron's Thor, which I enjoyed, but there just was like this synergy of art and story that Simonson did in his initial run there when he came on that I think was just. To me, it just shook everything up. I mean, the first thing he did was destroy the logo on the cover with Beta Ray Bill, and it was just like a moment of just like, whoa, what's going on? And it was a moment of change, I think, and it just kind of caught my eye.
It's funny if you look at, and I preface what I'm about to say by saying that I'm, as far as art, I'm not like a gallery art connoisseur, expert, or anything like that, but because I am a comic nerd, I can rattle off, at least a few big name comic book artists, whereas I couldn't tell you any modern, you know, gallery artists' names, you know, really out there, and that's coming from a guy. I mean, I've got I have a friend of mine. She's very talented. She's in Columbus, Ohio. She has, you know, new artists getting some things in some galleries and having some shows, things like that. But I couldn't, you know, it's funny that you said when you go to art school and your professors are kind of guiding you away from, you know, one possible medium and trying to I don't know if pigeonhole is the right word, but you know, trying to steer you in this particular direction. Whereas, again, because of my interest, you know, I John Romita Jr., Jack King Kirby, you know, those are Neil Adams. Those are some of the art icons that I'm, you know, so familiar with. Todd McFarlane, another one. So it's just funny because of my background and my interest that those are names, when someone says artists, that those are names that come to mind.
Well, yeah, the art world, the you know, the gallery world has its own agenda to put forward, and you know, high art, low art, the sort of outsider art, blah 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 art. You know, they at the time when I was going to school, everyone had very specific rules. Art, you know, like drawing was this type of thing, and painting was this type of thing, and sculpture was this type of thing. And so, you know, to elevate, for the teachers that worked within those mediums to elevate their portion of art, they had to create this sort of, you know, hierarchy and this attitude that certain things were better than other things. So illustration and comic book drawing was something that was just seen as not worthy of time. And, you know, and that's just, it's unfortunate. And I think it's changed a bit. I haven't been to school in a long time, so I don't know exactly. But I have a feeling that that it's sort of illustrative approach that people have now is a lot more, you know, is embraced more by teachers and institutions. But at the time when I was going, it was something that was a no-no, and it did eventually just suck. That whole notion of drawing, like illustrative drawing, was taken away, and you know, if the drawing didn't have some sort of, you know, super high charge meaning, or, you know, it couldn't be figurative, it had to be an expressive way of either your soul or the materials or whatever. And you know, it just, after years of getting pushed in that direction, it just became easier to do that than continue doing comics on the side while I was doing art school. So it, you know, it was one of those things that just happened gradually. And then once I got out of school, I realized that doing a gallery stuff wasn't really what I wanted to do anyways. But at that point, it was a little too late.
So what was the, I guess, catalyst that made you, you know, pick up the pencil and get, you know, just go back to, you know, maybe the passion of the illustrative or comic book art? What was there a specific moment in, you know, that you can remember that says, you know what, the gallery stuff's great, but it's not for me. Let me just try this and see what happens. See if my talents lend towards that particular medium.
You know, I can't think of any one particular moment, but there is a comic book store that I went into, and they were selling the Marvel tryout book. I don't know if you remember that.
Explain that to the listeners who may not be familiar.
it was sort of like a submissions kit in one big book, and it was the pages, like the whole book itself was, you know, 11x17, and it was on Bristol board, really crappy Bristol board, but it was on Bristol board, and then it went through different chapters, the different stages of how a comic was made, and then gave you opportunity to do those particular skills on the board, and then you were supposed to send those in, and it was going to get judged, and then you were going to get a job from it. And I think it was Mark Bagley, who did Spider-Man for all those years. He actually won the original contest, so that's cool that, you know, that it actually worked out for him. But it was just this book that I bought, and it was years old. It had been out for, like, I don't know, 14 years or something. And it was
over.
Just there, and it was it hadn't been used, and so I just picked it up, and I started thumbing through it, and And yeah, it was an interesting look behind the curtain, I guess, and get a sense of what, you know, how to put together a comic and what all the steps were. Because this was sort of pre-internet, just when internet was sort of coming in. So getting that sort of information was a lot more difficult.
I was just about to ask, you know, about what year that was. Because as you alluded to, there's a little bit of an age difference in, you know, between you and I. And I remember when the internet started. I'm not going to say when it started, but, you know, when it became a little bit more mainstream. So I'm assuming at this point for you is probably mid to late 90s, maybe 96, 97?
Yeah. Yeah, by the time I picked that book up and started kind of thinking about it, yeah, it would have been mid-90s. Yeah. And I had just finished school at that point and was kind of just trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I working full-time in music retail, and I knew that wasn't something that I wanted to spend my entire life doing. And I knew I wanted it to be art-related, but it just was one of those things where I didn't want to be an art, like a studio, a gallery artist. So, you know, after all those years of doing school and you know, having this full-time retail job, and it was just sort of like me looking around trying to figure out exactly where I wanted to go with my life. So I guess when I got that book, it was just sort of a peek behind the curtain, and it kind of helped me think about how a comic book was put together and where, you know, where I might fall within that sort of medium.
It's really funny that inspiration really can come from anywhere. I mean, in this case, you go into the comic store as, you know, the term that I've used a couple times, as a consumer, and you happen across this book, and you're like, man, let's, like you said, get that peek behind the curtain. Let's see a little bit about the magic that goes into, you know, the wonderful world of Oz, so to speak, if we're going to continue that curtain metaphor. And then from there, you're able to, you know, hone your skills to that particular style.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. You know, I'm still trying to figure out how I draw. It seems to change all the time. But
that's got to be, I mean, that's got to be common with any creator, though, right? Always evolving. I mean, musicians, you know, I've been fan of certain bands, and you know, their third and fourth albums don't sound anything like their first and second. Artists, writers, everybody evolves in a certain way.
Yeah, I think so. I think that I mean, that's a generalization. I think that there's definitely writers and artists who get comfortable and then don't really push you know, for anything new. Not to pick on anyone, but John Byrne is somebody who, growing up, I was a huge fan of his. And, you know, there was just a certain point where I don't think that he was passionate about it. It became a job. And you can kind of tell, because it never really felt like, you know, he got to a point that he was really comfortable, and then it just never felt like he ever pushed again. And to me, that's sad. I would never want to be, I would never want to stagnate. I would like to think that I'm always trying to push, you know, push the envelope and try to figure out new ways of doing things and such like that for myself. I mean, it might not be new for anyone else, but, you know, I think that the goal, at least I like to think of the goal of an artist, is to be always pushing to create something that they haven't created before. Because I wouldn't want a career where I just did the exact same thing over and over again, the same way over and over again.
Would that be why, you know, another name I mentioned earlier, would that be like why a Todd McFarlane found so much success, because his style was so drastically different from, you know, most of his predecessors?
Yeah, oh, for sure. The whole image explosion, I mean, the way that that a lot of those guys drew was very different from what had come from, you know, had come before them. So, and it was just, you know, just a moment in time. It's kind of weird. You think, sometimes think, like, if that had happened, you know, even 6 or 7 years before, or six or seven years after that moment, you know, when Image was sort of coming together, like, would it have been as popular and would it have been as groundbreaking? It's an interesting thing to think about. I just think at the time, it was just sort of perfect timing where they were trying something that wasn't quite the same, and people were open to that.
Let's talk about your career as an artist, because right there on Front Street on your Facebook page, I mean, you've done work for Marvel and Boom Studios, Dark Horse, which obviously we'll talk about with Kill All Monsters and beyond. What was your first big art gig?
Well, that's a good question. I bounced around quite a bit. I was doing lots of like collaboration type stuff, working in anthologies, you know, essentially working for free, trying to network and create, a network of people and creators and writers and artists that I felt comfortable with, and that, you know, we could share ideas and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's been a really long travel, you know, my overnight sensation sort of thing that took 15 years to get here. But, and not saying that I'm an overnight sensation, but you know what I'm getting at. just that, the biggest thing that I'd done that was sort of like, whoa, would have been I did an issue of Daredevil with Mark Waid and Chris Somney during their run. And that was probably like the biggest thing up until, like, anything that was before that would have been mostly just self-published or, I had been in a few things. I'm looking at my wall here trying to figure out the chronological order of some of the books that I did, but, I did some stuff with some Perhaponaut stuff with Todd DeZago and Craig Russo, and that was through Image. I had done a chapter of Masks of Mobsters that Josh Williamson and Mike Henderson was doing that Image. You know, I had done these sort of small little fill-ins and that sort of stuff for a number of years, and then once I got the one issue of Daredevil, things kind of opened up after that.
Is that because that Mark Waid run on Daredevil? I mean, obviously, it's, you know, Daredevil's one of I consider the legacy characters in Marvel, certainly, but you know, Waid's one of the premier writers as well. So was it just because it was the writer that you were working with, the character that you were working on, the title you were working on? What was it about that kind of served as the launching point, so to speak?
Well, I think just the steam that book had going, Chris and Mark were firing on all cylinders for a couple of years before I did issue 33. So they had already been doing it for a couple of years, and they were just, you know, they were just making great work. So the idea of being part of that was really exciting. And I think that because the book was popular, and and my name got thrown out there a little bit, that some editors at Boom decided that maybe they would give me a shot at a few things, and, you know, and it opened some doors. But I think mostly just, you know, the flash of the whole idea of, you know, Daredevil, because it was really riding high at that point. So, you know, I think it was just the mystique, I guess, of being on a title like that made people a little bit more aware of me.
So how does that conversation go? How do they reach out to you, or vice versa, that you end up doing an issue of Daredevil? To walk me through that, tell me that story.
Oh, geez, that's a long, convoluted story. It really comes down to Mark Waid. I'm trying to remember all the steps, but I had done a story in an anthology that Brian Buccellato was doing. I'm blanking on the title. Oh, Foster. It was a self-titled thing that Brian was doing. And then the letter and the writer of that story that I did in the anthology, Troy Petrie, Troy Petrie, he was doing all of the lettering for Thrillbent. Remember Thrillbent? It's Mark Waid's online imprint.
Okay.
And so Troy was doing all the work, doing all the lettering for that stuff. And so Troy showed him the work that I was doing in Foster, and then Mark Waid liked it, and so we were chatting. I met him a couple times at conventions, and then it just was one of these things where he said he was interested in working with me, and I'm obviously interested in working with him, but just our schedules never really lined up, and all that sort of stuff. And then they just needed somebody for Daredevil because they had a gap. And because I think Chris and his wife were just having a child. I think that was sort of one of the reasons for the gap. So Mark just put my name in with the editor, Stephen Wacker, and I guess all the stars aligned and the moon shone on the sacred dagger or whatever. And they offered it to me. Like, just one day I got an email while I was at work saying, hey, what do you think of doing an issue of Daredevil? And it was just like, well, after I finished doing my happy dance, I wrote back and I said, yeah, damn straight, sign me up. So, it really came down to Mark Waid, and it was just sort of this trickle of things, working with Brian, and then working with Troy, and Troy worked with Mark, and then I talked to Mark. It's one of those networking things, and just luck and being at the right place at the right time.
Was that one of the higher stress, higher pressure jobs that you've had? I mean, I would imagine probably a maybe more stricter deadline than what you would have perhaps on other projects, or...
Yeah, for sure. I actually took time off my job. I was working at the library at that point here in Vancouver, and I took a couple months off because I wanted to make sure that I could focus fully on it. And I had six weeks to do it. And but I was actually at an advantage because Chris Omni supplied the layouts for it. He had laid it all out. And if you've ever seen Chris's layouts, They're pretty tight. So I didn't really have to do a whole lot of work in terms of penciling. I tightened up certain things, hands or faces or some background stuff. But generally, it was all there for me. So hitting the deadline was no problem. But as soon as I was finishing that, that's when I started getting work from Boom. They offered me something on their RoboCop book. And... yeah, and then it just sort of started snowballing. Of course, I'm blanking on all the things that came after, but I it was one of those things where it's just like once the Daredevil thing sort of was talked about, there was stuff for me to do now. And so I never ended up going back to the library. Just one gig kind of opened up to the next gig, and then I just stopped working at the library.
We're able to turn it into full-time work. And I would imagine that for many artists, even if they get that one shot, it doesn't always parlay into the full-time, aspect where they're able to, do that as a career. So, tip of the cap to you for being able to pull that off, because there are so many, people out there who fancy themselves artists or who are, and I say that not in any derogatory manner, but... there, got to be, phone books full of people who want to be full-time comic book artists, and few people who, are selected. So, credit to you, obviously, to be able to make that happen.
Well, I think a lot of the credit actually goes to my wife.
You know,
I wouldn't be able to do this full time without her support. Really, as wonderful as the story could be told about how I've stood up on my own two feet and pulled myself up by my bootstraps. I mean, I work hard, but without her, I wouldn't have been able to do this full time.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned Jackie, because what you didn't tell me when we were setting this up, and we've been trying to get together for a couple weeks now here in the last going, and you were out of town, and then I didn't know you were back in town, so you know, here we are. But as we record this on Wednesday night, it's actually your anniversary, man.
And, it is, and she's giving me the stink eye right now.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you you know, brought her in to the conversation. Because I certainly want to offer my congratulations on 19 years married, and since we talked about it, you know, and brought her up, I got it. There's a story there. How did you meet your wife? That's a Nerd United first. I've never asked that question to anybody because nobody's ever been daring enough to talk with me on their anniversary.
Oh, well, you know, once you've been married 19 years. No. Yeah, you know, just a mutual friend, actually. The guy that I went to high school with, he was working at this one job, and he was working with Jackie. And, you know, just through a mutual friend, essentially, we went to a few of the same parties and we ended up knowing some of the same people. And then eventually we just were like, hey, how's it going? And it was just like essentially the one evening when we decided that we would be together was an Oktoberfest. And it was really sad because I'm not very good at expressing myself sometimes. So I had my friend go over and talk to my wife's or Jackie's best friend, and say, hey, Jason kind of likes Jackie. And then her best friend said, oh, Jackie kind of likes Jason. And we just ended up meeting kind of on the dance floor, and then that was it. We were together ever since. So.
It's a reverse telephone game, you know, where you pass along the message and hope that the message is received in its entirety. Well, that's wonderful. Congratulations to you, and thank you to Jackie for sparing, you know, you a little bit of time this evening to chat. Let's talk a bit about we've obviously got to talk about Kill All Monsters. And what we learned, what I learned from Michael when I talked to him a couple of weeks back, was that it actually started out as an online comic. So walk us through, because this was, you know, I think a lot of the common perception is that, you know, a writer comes up with the concept, and then after he has some type of, you know, story in mind, reaches out to an artist. But Michael really said, hey, you know, that Jason always kind of wanted to draw monsters and robots. So walk me through, you know, that the conversation and the conceptualization of Kill All Monsters.
Well, that really started. So Michael was doing some work on a kind of like a comics web blog thing, so we just kind of met naturally through the internet, and then I just mentioned that I was interested in drawing kind of robots and monsters and that sort of thing, and another mutual friend of ours was like, oh, you guys should work together. And he kind of, his name's Alex Ness, he kind of was like, what about, and I guess he kind of came up with a little bit of a structure for it. And Michael and I just sort of looked at each other and said, yeah, that sounds really cool. And then Alex wasn't really interested in, that's about as far as he wanted to go. He's just like, you know, you guys do whatever you want with it. So it morphed over time. Michael and I would talk back and forth and that sort of thing. And then, would end up doing stuff on it in between things when I was, you know, when I had some downtime from other stuff. And then at a certain point we had pitched it. We actually did a full 28-page comic, And we pitched it, and no one took it. So then we reworked it a little bit more, and we did a 5 or 6 page full color pitch for it. And again, no one was really that interested, and we got some interesting feedback. And then, so I kind of came to a crossroad where Michael and I were just sort of looking at this thing, kind of going, you know, we really want to do this, but no one seems interested. And we're just like, well, why don't we just put it on the web? Like, let's just do a web comic. And so Michael was into it, and so we just started working. And he had a certain chunk of story written, but he definitely didn't have it written past a certain point. And then he would just feed me pages, and whenever I got a chance, I'd start putting some ink down. And then once we had a certain kind of backlog of pages, we decided that we would start putting it online. And we stuck to a pretty good pace for about 6 months. I think we were putting up 3 pages a week for like about 3 months or something, or 4 months. And so we had amassed a certain number of pages. It was about 83 pages online. And then we just kind of, I was at a point where I was starting to do lots of comic book shows, go to cons and stuff. And I wanted a book to put on my table. And I was like, well, you know, what do you think about turning the Kill a Monster webcomic into like an actual book that we can get printed? And Michael was down for it. So he finished another chunk of pages. And over a course of, I don't know how long, but it felt like forever, I was doing work on it on the side. And then we kickstarted it, and it turned into an actual book.
We talked about this, and it's no secret now in 2017, but the internet, I mean, it's making people. I mean, YouTube and he's your own countryman, so I gotta kind of blame you, not you personally, but you collectively. But you know, without the internet, we wouldn't have Justin Bieber.
Woohoo!
Yeah, you're right. You sound yeah.
I'm glad you guys have them. We don't have them.
Well, it was funny because wasn't it the Olympic hockey a couple years back where you know we were trying to say, hey, if we win, you've got to take him back. And And of course, it's U.S. versus Canada in hockey, so we all know how that one went.
But well, that was down to the wire, that one, though.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, it's still U.S. and Canada in hockey. I mean, it's like U.S. and Canada in curling. I think we know who's going to win. But there's just some things that Canada beats us at. Universal health care, for example.
That's a slippery road. I don't think you want to go that way.
No, I, you know, we tend to avoid politics on Nerds United because we try to not, you know, we try to be all inclusive. We love everybody. because of the internet, you know, creators are able to get their stuff out there, and even if they're not, you know, before the Kickstarter, when you were just releasing a few pages, you know, a week, I'm sure those were just free, right? I mean, you weren't asking for anything. That was just, you know, for lack of a better term, labor of love, that you were, you know, eventually able to turn into something material in book form, and of course now the omnibus. But that's you know, without the internet, I mean, you know, I'm by no means am I an internet superstar or sensation, or nothing I've ever done has gone viral. But I'm able to visit with you and get you know, this story, this conversation out to the people, and so the internet does do some good things. A lot of batshit crazy stuff, but does some good things as well. So when you go from, you know, putting a few pages out a week over, you know, 3 or 6 month span, then you have a book that you can put on a table at Comic Cons, then you have a Kickstarter, and as Michael said, then, you know, you sold Kill All Monsters to a publishing company that lets you that, you know, super good, you know, as far as, you know, good people, good bit, you know, but they let you keep the rights so that you were able to progress your story to the next level, and that's where Dark Horse picks it up.
Yeah, yeah. So after we did the Kickstarter for the book, and we got it printed and stuff, I was doing a show at it was C2E2 in Chicago, and I had a table, and I had all my stuff out. I had the Killer Monster book out, and a guy came to my table, and we were chatting and talking about stuff, and he was saying, he was looking at my prints, and he was looking at all this stuff, and he was like, oh, I really like your work. I'm like, oh, thanks. And he picked up, you know, Kill Monsters, and he's like, you know, what are you working on? I said, well, we just finished this book, and then I'm putting together a pitch with Kurt Piers, and he's like, oh, you know, why don't you, when you finish that up, just send it to me. And I was like, okay, who are you? And it turned out that I was talking to Dave Marshall, who is a editor at Dark Horse, and he was essentially giving me an open door to pitch stuff to him. And I was just like, oh, that's pretty awesome. So as he was leaving, you know, I handed him a Kill a Monster book. And I said, you know, I hope you enjoy it. And then, so we ended up doing, Kurt and I ended up doing Pop. That was through Dark Horse. And we pitched to Dave, and Dave was our editor. And then Kurt did another thing called The Tomorrows, and I did an issue of that. It was a six-issue thing. Which each issue had a different artist, and I was the artist on the first issue. So that, again, that was Dave. And then, so as that was finishing up, I just kind of said, hey, Dave, what do you think of the idea of Dark Horse putting together a Kill a Monster hardcover of the old stuff and then some new stuff? And so he pitched that to Michael Richardson, the big cheese there at Dark Horse. And he came back, and he's like, not only does Mike want to do the book, but he wants Kill Monsters in Dark Horse Presents, which was like, what? So so we ended up doing a short story, which is in the omnibus, did a short story that ran in three issues of Dark Horse Presents, and I got to do the cover for one of those issues, which was really cool. And then then I just worked on Kill Monsters again, kind of in between stuff, because I did another thing for Marvel, and what was I doing? I was doing covers for Boom and stuff. So I was doing the Kill a Monster stuff still sort of on the side while I was doing this other, the other work. And then once we got, once I had a good chunk of time, I just plowed through all the Kill a Monster stuff that Michael had written, and then delivered the book. And then it was a waiting game, because what they wanted to do, they wanted to hit the book market. So like at Barnes & Noble and Chapters and all that sort of stuff. They've got distribution through, I think, Random House Penguin. Mm-hmm. And so it had to get slotted in to a certain time zone. So even though we had finished fairly early, it couldn't come out till the summer of this year. So it was sort of in, I wouldn't say limbo, because it was coming out, but it was one of those things where it was just kind of a waiting game for it to kind of hit the shelves. So... yeah, and then it hit comic stores in July, mid-July, and then it hit bookstores at the 1st of August. So it's still, you know, a fairly fresh new book. It's only a month and a bit old, and we're really proud of it. It's amazing. Dark Horse did such a great job with the actual, you know, making of the book, the binding and the paper and everything. It's just fantastic. So we're super happy.
What has, and I asked this, you know, to Michael as well, but, you know, two different people and, you know, talking to two different, you know, groups in different areas, but what has your feedback been, the reception been to you about the Kill All Monsters omnibus?
Well, it's been really great. I haven't heard anybody say anything bad about it, other than the fact that they feel that it's not quite finished. And you know, when Michael wrote what he had written, it felt like it had sort of finished in a spot that could be the end. But I've had a few readers kind of say that they felt that it there needs to be more, which there's more coming. Mm-hmm. But it was just one of those things where it was sort of like, it felt like it was a good, it felt like an ending me, but apparently to some people there needs to be more. So Michael and I are working on more.
That's, you know, got to be I can't think of the right word that I want to use, but you know, gosh darn, when these people want more out of you, you know, that's got to be you know, a shot to the gut. No, I'm kidding. I want to go back to something, and Michael touched on this as well. But tell me the importance of seeing your work in Dark Horse Presents, because that's a very historic, I guess, and maybe that's not the right word, but that's something that, you know, can make a profound impact on a career.
Yeah, well, I think it was something that I'd always thought about. Like, it was like, especially when they relaunched it, and there was lots of short stories and kind of, you know, mini series sort of started in there. I know that Michael Omien did, I think it was called Victory, was in that. And there was, you know, a bunch of stuff that was being put in there. And in the back of my brain, it was always like, oh, I want to pitch something, you know, that would be part of Dark Horse Presents, because to me, Dark Horse Presents has always been a really interesting collection of talent. You know, it's sort of like heavy metal in terms of you don't necessarily like every story. You know, you don't like the art in on every story, or you don't like the story for every you know, story that's in there. But it gives you. They always seem to attempt to have a wide range of voices in terms of art and story. And I think that that's really exciting. And that's something that needs to be cultivated in comics, so that, you know, you'll always get something different. Because I believe that comics need to always have fresh ideas and fresh ways of doing things, you know, just to keep the medium bubbling and interesting. So, Dark Horse Presents to me was always one of those books that always seemed to take chances where a lot of publishers and lots of books won't take those chances. So being part of that, it was really cool.
So after Kill All Monsters, and following your social media, I see that you've been working on some Judge Dredd. How did that come about?
Again, it's the writer. it's a common thread through my career. The writer, Ulysses, he essentially put my name in there. He contacted me via Facebook. I mean, we follow each other, and we've been talking about working together for quite some time. And it was one of those things where he was like, hey, what are your thoughts about working on Judge Dredd? And I was like, dude, that would be amazing. So, so he just kind of put my name in there. And, you know, I guess having done a certain amount of stuff, the editors were cool with me coming on board. So I did three issues. The third one, which is number five in the series, because I did three, four, and five. Number five just came up, like, today. So, so that's kind of the end of my Dredd, which is kind of sad, but, it came out today and it looks fantastic. Ryan Hill did the coloring for it and he's fantastic. He really makes everything just look so good. And I think we work really well together. He understands, how to color my work and I was floored with how it all came out, which is really cool.
And that was going to be my next question, because I know oftentimes, you know, the process can take, you know, several months, you know, you could be drawing in March for something that's not coming out until August. So the fact that you just finished up and then it's already, you know, published and out there, it seems to me that that's a pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah, they were behind. There was some sort of production issue, and they needed guys to kind of pick up the pace a little bit. So I did three books in 3 months. I was on a 4-week schedule, which is pretty tight. I gotta tell you, there were a couple of sleepless nights at the end of each deadline, but. I'm proud of the work I did, and I'm especially proud of the fact of that I did it in 4 weeks, and I did it 3 months in a row. So, that's one of those feather in the cap sort of things. I can kind of pat myself on the back. I know it was only 3 months, but you know, the idea of doing a monthly book is, it seems like it's easy. You know, people who read comics think, oh, they should be able to do this in a month. But doing 20 pages of art in essentially 20 days is pretty taxing, you know, and it's not something that is really that easy.
I definitely don't take it for granted the amount of work and time that goes into creating something that I eventually hold in my hand and, you know, turn the page and sit there and enjoy. So for all of us, you know, comic nerds who feel that same way, we appreciate, you know, I think by and large, we appreciate the amount of effort, the lack of sleep, that, you know, so many of you collectively creators, you know, be it writers or artists, when you got to hit a deadline and, you know, it's like, crap, it's the 20th day of the month and I've got a page and a half yet I've got to crank out, put the coffee on and forget about sleep because it's got to get done. You know, we appreciate that because, you know, I know the publisher has to as well, because the last thing they, you know, want is, or can afford is a delay in production. So, tip of the cap to you in regards to that. So now that Judge Dredd has, you know, even though it's three issues, I mean, it's monthly work, but what's next for you?
Well, I'm currently writing my very first graphic novel, which I will also be illustrating. So I'm in the middle of writing it right now. I've got it to a point where, I can see maybe about 2 more months of writing to kind of hammer out all the kinks and stuff. And then I'm going to start drawing it.
Will this be the first, first time that you've sat down to write anything? Or I mean, is this just kind of the first opportunity that you've had to write a comic or?
It's mostly the first time. Well, I've drawn a few of my own short stories, but they've been, you know, very short, no more than no more than like maybe 10 or 15 pages mm-hmm. long. This, my writing is not structured like most writers or probably all writers. I haven't broken it down into pages and such. It's mostly one giant collection of beats and then obviously some sort of stuff about setting and that sort of stuff and dialogue. But I think a lot of it is in right now is kind of in flux, so I'm hesitant to really try to write a traditional type script until everything feels like it is in place. But that's my own, like, it's my own sort of fumbling around the whole idea of writing, because I don't have a specific, you know, point of reference of how to do it. So I'm just sort of doing it the way it feels comfortable to me.
And that's leads me really well into my question that you kind of just answered, is because you come from the artist side of it, do you see the story differently even when you're trying to write it? Like, you know, would you almost do maybe make a storyboard of it very rough and go that way, or would you actually try to you know, build a maybe not a formal script but at least some type of outline in written form?
Yeah, it'd definitely be a more of a written outline. I might even break it down into I hesitate to say pages, but it definitely will be into sort of like acts. So I get a sense of how long an act is and at what point, you know, I should switch gears and move along. I haven't decided how much of it I'm going to try to nail down in the script form. I kind of don't want it to be, I'd rather the drawing part of it be where a lot of the nuances happen.
Sure.
As opposed to in the script, and then try to illustrate what I've written. I kind of want more of a free flow. I don't want to say that it's going to be a certain number of pages, and then either go too long or too short, that sort of thing. I kind of just want to let it go as I draw it and kind of pace it as I go. All things are fluid, and I may change my mind by the time I finish writing it. It might be like a traditional script. I'm not exactly sure what the final form will be, but I have a feeling that it'll be fairly fluid and in the details, the visual details. You know, I want to make sure all the plot stuff's there, but I might not be really specific about what the characters are doing until I'm actually, you know, drawing it.
Sure. And also, while this is a Jason Copeland production, written and drawn by, you know now enough writers that you can say, if you wanted to go this route, you could probably say, hey, look this over. Do I need to tweak anything? Or do you want to just make it a sole, independent, just you type of work? I mean, would you lean on Michael, since you've, you know, worked with him for years, and say, man, I need a quippy line of dialogue. This is the situation, or, you know, something like that, or
yeah. I don't know. I think I have a real difficult time with criticism, and so I don't know if I'd take. I think I might be better at taking writing criticism because I haven't really poured a whole lot of years into it.
Sure.
So I can kind of step back maybe, but right now I haven't really thought too much into the next step other than just getting it down on paper. I definitely have had friends, writer friends, who have offered to look stuff over. So I think I'm sure it will happen at some point. I just don't know to what level of detail I really want people to criticize or not criticize, but you know what I mean. But then, you know, on the other hand, I understand fully the importance of having somebody look at it critically and kind of rip it apart if there's things that need to be fixed. I think that pretending that I know exactly what I'm doing and no one else can tell me how to make it better, there's no way that is something that is going to come off very well. So I think, you know, I'm sure I will lean on friends, and I might even hire an editor. I work with Jim Gibbons at Dark Horse and at Stila, and he's great. So I don't know. I might even go that route where I just hire out an editor to really, you know, rip through it, you know, and then kind of deal with the aftermath and that sort of thing. I don't have a real timeline other than the fact that I might run out of money one of these days, but I kind of want it to be ready to go and drawable probably by the end of November. So I don't really have a whole lot of time for rewrites and stuff like that. But we'll see, I guess. We'll see how it goes.
So I have a very rudimentary understanding of trademark and copyright law, but it's my basic understanding that if you say with intent, this is what you plan to do, then that becomes your intellectual property, trademarked, casually or anything like, but what I'm getting at is, can you tell us anything about this story that you're working on, or are you going to play those cards close to your chest until you're a little further down in the process?
I could probably talk a little bit about it, but I don't have an elevator pitch. I probably won't sell it very well right now because it's it's still kind of in flux. I'm still trying to get a grasp of exactly, you know, what kind of themes and stuff I might want to push through it. But it's essentially set in sort of a near future metropolis, like huge metropolis. And it's sort of a crime. It's a crime story. Dealing with mob-like families that are coming together for a common thing, and then it all gets kind of blown apart, and then the main character has to sort of deal with the ramifications of what happens when this sort of coming together fails drastically. So it's kind of like Blade Runner meets what do you like this Hollywood thing where you take different franchises, but it's sort of like Blade Runner meets The Warriors.
All right.
And a little bit of that sort of the main character is in a lot of trouble, and everybody is out for him. So he has to deal with all sorts of different obstacles that pop up. I wanted to be like Full Tilt is the name of the book, and I want it to have that sort of nonstop feel to it. So once the premise, the first 20 pages or whatever happens, and the story sort of put into motion, I really want it to be, popping and things happening all the time, and really moving at a decent pace, so that it never feels like it's stagnant and that sort of thing. So it's going to be interesting because excuse me, I want to make sure that there's lots of character development in it, but at the same time I don't want to slow it down too much and focus too heavily on certain scenes and that sort of stuff. I kind of want it to be have an energy and kind of always keeping people moving forward.
Well, I know you say it may not be the best elevator pitch, but you sold me a copy because as soon as you said, big metropolis in this, slight future with a bit of that mobster twist, it's actually funny that you mentioned Blade Runner, because my mind went to Blade Runner when you said, slightly, or huge, kind of megalopolis type of place. So I was thinking, as you're describing, I'm like, is he going to say Blade Runner meets The Godfather?
Yeah, no, it definitely, it's weird. It has like organized crime stuff in it, but I definitely don't feel like it's leaning anywhere towards what people would probably traditionally think of as like crime, like mafia story. It's part of the dressing, but it's more about the need for the character to sort of get through sort of the underlying story of what happened that kicked it all off. So it's sort of like
like a crime noir.
Yeah, it'll have that sort of feel to it. It's kind of, I hesitate to say detective story. There'll definitely be parts of the story that will get revealed as you go that will hopefully make people go, oh, okay, and make sense of things that had already happened that might not make sense at the time that you're reading it. So hopefully I'm not making this too exciting, because it might suck. But this is my goal. These are the things that in my brain, I can kind of visualize. Hopefully I can pull it off. So we'll see.
I'm looking forward to it. And I hope as we get closer to, I don't know if there's a Kickstarter in your future or, a publishing of it, but I hope we can get together again and talk more about Full Tilt. But Jason, I appreciate all the time that you've been able to give me, and I apologize apologize on my behalf to Jackie for taking you away on this most sacred of evenings on your 19th anniversary. So apologies to her and for interfering, but thanks so much for your time, and thanks for being a guest on Nerds United, man. It was a great chat.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it a lot, Greg.
And that's Jason Copeland. Make sure, again, if you haven't yet, you can check out Kill All Monsters, the Omnibus Volume 1. Go to your local comic book store, or as we learned in the Michael May episode a couple weeks back, anywhere where fine Penguin books are sold, or if you wanted to get it online and not support your local store, if you don't have a local store, you can also get it on Amazon. It's also there as well. But support your local comic shop. Damn it. They need your help, and while you're there, this has been a big issue in the brick and mortar industry. If you have a pull order, if you have a pull folder, buy the damn things. Don't let them sit there and accumulate dust for 3 months. Get over to your store, support them, and keep those guys and gals in business. They'll be appreciative, and you'll have a great place to go and talk comics, just like we do here on Nerds United. Again, Jason Copeland, my guest. This time around, and thanks to him, and thanks for all of your support here on Nerds United, the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network, jitterymonkey.com, all the great shows that you can find there, like My 123 Cents, the podcast, if you're a pro wrestling fan, or Positive Cynicism, as they break away from political talk, and in fact, this past episode, they break down 1991 in music, in rap, and hip-hop, which is funny coming from a couple of white dudes in their 40s, but I don't judge. It was a great episode, and I learned a lot. Or my other podcast with Brian Toll, the Five Heart Podcast, there for you if you're a Nebraska Cornhusker fan. Hey, we're 1-0, so hopefully we can go to Oregon and get a win there. But this is Nerds United, and I appreciate all your support. If you haven't already, go to iTunes, leave a review, a rate. If you love it, great. If you don't love it, let me know about it. Let me know why. But thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. And thanks again to Jason Copeland for joining me on Nerds United this week.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.